The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable John W. Turner presiding.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. We're here on Yarborough as the administrator of the estate of Jones versus the City of Springfield. City of Springfield being the appellant in this case. That's court case number 4220025. Would counsel for the appellant please identify yourself for the record?
Randall Mead for Drake Nerrip and Mead for the appellant.
Thank you. And for the appellee, would you please state your name for the record?
Todd Bresney for the estate, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Mead, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel. The primary question to be answered today is whether the record shows facts which justify sending the liability question to the jury. That is, whether there is evidence sufficient to prove willful and wanton conduct in the manner in which the city operated its beach. And we argue that there is no such justification to allow that to go to the jury, and that the trial court erred in denying our motion for judgment NOV. I think more fundamentally, the question is whether the substantive law of immunity, municipal tort immunity, can be determined by the adverbs that a plaintiff chooses to use in her complaint. In 2007, Eric Jones, then age 16, drowned at the Lake Springfield Beach. It was owned and managed by the City of Springfield, which is subject to the immunities passed by the legislature. All of the allegations of the complaint had the adverb willfully and wantonly in front of the verb of alleged wrongdoing on the city's part. All the allegations really sounded in negligence, and there are no claims that set out any sort of egregious conduct that would be worthy of being called willful and wanton, at least as that term is defined by the act itself. Of course, the type of pleading is done because the state of Illinois enacted immunity statutes to partially immunize municipalities in tort cases like this one. The purpose is, it's cited in the Van Meter case that I cited in my brief, where the Supreme Court said the act, the Immunity Act, serves to protect local public entities and public employees from liability arising from the operation of government. By providing immunity, the General Assembly sought to prevent the dissipation of public funds on damage awards in tort cases. So exactly the situation.
Mr. Mead, let me stop you there. Your argument seems to be proceeding along the lines as if the jury had not been instructed properly about what willful and wanton conduct is. And you're not making that argument, are you?
No, they were properly instructed on what the standard was.
And that means that they had to have found that there was a conscious disregard for the safety of others, right?
That's correct.
Okay, and why is, you say it's a play on adverbs or language, but if that's the definition of willful and wanton, and the it was submitted properly to the jury, what is your concern about that being, why is that improper, I guess, is my question.
The whole point is that the trial court itself has to serve as a gatekeeper in determining whether to allow this to go to a jury or to undo what a jury does later. Now, we believe that this is a highly sympathetic case, as are a lot of these death cases. And in fact, I'm talking outside the law, a jury will ignore. I mean, I'm just speaking as a trial lawyer. A jury will tend to ignore some of the instructions just to reach a desired remedy for a grieving mother, as in this case. That's why I think it's important for the trial court to be always cognizant of what the purpose of these immunity statutes are, to protect the public purse. This is the, you know, I've been criticized in my brief for talking about how the effect of ignoring these immunity statutes is most keenly felt by people who are disadvantaged. And that's true. So we have to keep in mind, if you want to have swimming pools, if you want to have swimming beaches, if you want to have public playgrounds, ignoring the immunity statutes and allowing cases to go tacitly forward on mere negligence allegations, as here, then you're going to put all that at risk because the cities won't afford the liability.
Does the record reflect whether the beach is still open to the public?
It's closed. I believe it. I believe that's reflected there somewhere. So this is why we can't have nice things argument, if you will. We can't do things to serve the public if we constantly run the risk of being found willfully and wantonly misconduct when it's actually a negligence case. And I think that this is the perfect example of a case like that. Continuing, the statute itself, I'm sorry, Justice Turner, did I answer your question sufficiently?
Yeah, you answered it. Thank you.
Thank you. You can't sue a city for mere negligence. You have to prove willful and wanton misconduct in order to recover. The statute itself defines willful and wanton conduct as a course of conduct which shows an actual or deliberate intention to cause harm, or which, if not intentional, shows an utter indifference or a conscious disregard for the safety of others or their property. This is not an intentional case. So we're at the second phrase of that definition, utter indifference to or conscious disregard for the safety of others. As I point out in the brief, utter, giving it the plain meaning of that word, means total or absolute. So absolute indifference. Conscious means knowing. So you had to know that this was going on, that this young man was drowning and didn't care. That's the standard in plain English that the plaintiff has to prove. And that's not the situation here at all.
Is it that they didn't care, or the entity did not care that the boy was drowning, or is it more accurately the phrase, they were indifferent to the things that they might have done to prevent that kind of drowning or to facilitate a much earlier rescue?
That could be argued.
Thank you.
Excuse me, counsel, along those same lines, should there be consideration given to the nature of the activity, in this case, the city, the beach area? And I think this follows with my colleague's question, the nature of any potential dangers in that operation, the actions taken.
I think it absolutely should. We can't take these in isolation. We have to look at exactly what's going on in terms of what the risks are, drowning, of which there was no evidence that any drowning had ever occurred at this beach before. Or do we look at it from, more closely to the situation? Is the risk that they need to guard against being a 16-year-old, 6-foot-tall individual consciously going into murky waters up to his neck when he knew he couldn't swim, and then engaging in horseplay in that deep area of the lake? That's really the danger that the city's being asked to defend against here, not simply drowning. So I think you have to look at cases like this as a whole, from both what the plaintiff is doing and from what the defendant did to try to prevent this, either prior to the action or to in the search itself and the attempt to rescue.
On the public policy issue, you gave 3 examples. This is why we can't have nice things, or if the city wants to provide activities. And you mentioned swimming pools, playgrounds, and lakes. Do you think perhaps someone might assess the risk much differently of something like this happening in open water as opposed to an injury on a playground or an incident of a swimmer in trouble in a swimming pool?
Yeah, I think they all have their unique set of risks, and I think that they have to be looked at separately. Well,
I would suggest that the risk for open water is greater. I can't say that that's not a matter of law unless the court said it, but in terms of assessing the risk, if I were a municipality, I know that if I've got a swimming pool, I need certified lifeguards. If I've got open water, I'm supposed to have lifeguards that are open water certified. Now, I might not be clear on the facts, but most of the lifeguards that are involved were not open water certified.
There may have been one. I'm not quite sure on that, but they were all certified. But
certified lifeguards.
I'm not aware of any statute that requires open water certification for a public swimming area.
You're exactly right. I don't think there is any statute.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, you answer my question. Thank you.
Okay, great. And I appreciate that. I think the idea is that you have to do an assessment in reality, not in a separate, in the context of a lawsuit. You know, what are we doing here to try to safeguard the public? Are we doing anything? Are we doing, and it's not, I don't think it's a matter of doing enough. And a matter of fact, the case law that we'll eventually get into, we'll talk about, it's not a question of, could you have done more? It's a question of, did you adequately, treat this situation? And does that rise somehow to the level of an utter indifference and conscious disregard for the safety of others? And of course, we submit here that it did not. Going through some of the
Council, for a little clarification, you're talking about public policy. You seem to be arguing lack of duty, but that's not really what your focus is in your briefs, is it?
It's not lack of duty. The duty is not to injure people willfully and wantonly, would be my summation of that. It's not a duty not to be negligent. It's something much more than that, for the public policy reasons of protecting the public fisc. I don't know that this is a duty question. The duty is conceded that we must not act willfully and wantonly. I think the question is, did the evidence justify going to the jury, or a finding of utter indifference and conscious disregard?
And as I understand, I'm sorry, Justice Turner, were you finished?
Yes.
I am, Justice
Turner. Oh, I'm sorry.
Please go ahead.
Counselor, and just focusing on that element for a moment, the argument that you present to this court is that, if I understand it correctly, you feel that in evaluating the uncontradicted evidence, that the matter should not have gone to the jury. Is that correct? That it was a complete defense as far as all the factual information that was presented and argued at that point? So the argument and the focus of your brief today is that there was not sufficient factual disputes to allow the matter to move forward to the jury?
Yes. Or in not granting the JNOV at the end. So it's 6 of 1, half a dozen of another, I suppose. The city, what did they do, as far as preparing for risk such as this? And this is all recited in the briefs and over again with the various witnesses. They provided signage, don't swim here if you're, a novice swimmer. They provided certified lifeguards, pre-trained. And this gets into the discretionary immunity argument a little bit, because, it's the discretion of the city as to, okay, we've got a public beach that we can open for the benefit free of charge to the public for a short season of about 3 months. Do we build and staff a lifeguard training facility for that, or do we rely on certified lifeguards who have been pre-trained, pre-certified, who know EAPs and all that good stuff? And the discretion of the city in choosing the latter you know, I think it's perfectly justifiable, but it's still a discretionary act. But I digress. They called safety meetings and exercises. So that's disputed testimony, but there was testimony to that effect. My notes say, anyway, that they did have open water lifeguards, at least some of them. But I think that those were not many compared to the total number, if I recall the evidence correctly. They put in buoy lines to demarcate the deep end from the shallow end. They had that signage both on the diving board or the lifeguard stands outside, and they had it in the locker room, so you had to walk right by it. They provided the guards the necessary safety equipment, megaphones, whistles, float tubes, CPR masks, backboards, etc. They provided beach managers, head lifeguards to organize and supervise. They provided some training efforts, even though they were all pre-certified, including the running jumping speed test as far as is this lifeguard able to do his or her job in being able to swim to the wall and back in a short amount of time, because time's of the essence in that situation. They actually adopted supervision standards far more stringent than those required by the state of Illinois. And on and on. They're all listed there. The testimony of the lifeguards, you know, if we're still being criticized for the way the lifeguards reacted, you have Dennis Caveney, who's the principal guard right at the location. He was informed, you know, that the swimmer was missing. Where at? Right here. He does his own grid search immediately in his discretion because of time being of the essence. You got to get this young man found and out of the water as quickly as possible. Where is he? He's right here. Okay, he did his own grid search rather than waiting to, okay, I'll blow the whistle and everybody will come running down. Then we'll leisurely hook our arms together at the shallow end of the pool and begin walking out into the water. No, he jumped in and immediately tried to rescue, which he testified was the EAP or emergency action plan for that specific type of a situation, using his judgment as a professional lifeguard.
Wasn't the testimony also that he was supposed to blow his whistle first to alert the other lifeguards?
There was testimony to that effect. Instead, what he did, rather than wasting time blowing the whistle, was he yelled at his compatriot lifeguard sitting a few feet away in the shallow action, Mr. Gable, if I recall, Gobble, and said what was going on and left it to Mr. Gobble to blow the whistle, to which there was ample testimony of people hearing the whistle, even up in a enclosed room in the lake house with air conditioning on. So there's no doubt about that being done. I think it's irrelevant who did it as long as it was done.
Does the evidence show how much time passed between the decedent going underwater until the recovery of his body?
I'm not familiar with anybody having a stopwatch for that situation. I recall that there was some testimony, but it was varied, and I just can't say with any certainty. And I don't think anybody had a certain amount of time. It was too long. For some reason, 5 minutes jumps into my head, and Todd can correct me on that. But I think that I don't think that that was really adequately documented.
Mr. Mead, I'm going to use a comparison, and I don't mean to say that the situations are too similar. But I was at a hotly contested basketball game last night. It doesn't take any time at all for a ref to blow a whistle. And I'm not really making light of that. I'm saying when you say wasting time blowing a whistle, a lifeguard ought to have a whistle readily available. And the additional 4 to 6 seconds that it would take to lift that whistle and blow it doesn't sound like wasting time to me.
Well, perhaps it would have
in his effort in diving in and trying to find the lad.
And in the coolness of hindsight, I could tend to agree with you. But if the referee in your basketball game were faced with an urgent situation and had the choice reactively, reflexively, to blow a whistle or render first aid, for example, I think he would render first aid. So, it doesn't take time to blow a whistle. I would agree with that. Instead, he's like, I'm going to get in the water as quickly as I can. I'm going to yell at my colleague to initiate the whistleblowing and gathering the troops on the shore. I think that's reasonable. But whatever it is, it's not willful and wanton. So my time's running out. I'm sorry. We good? I wanted to just mention the case law in passing, Barr versus Cunningham. I know that there's an exception in that about known dangers or unknown dangers. But I think when we're talking public policy like this, it's important. You know, Cunningham instituted several safeguards to prevent injuries. And it shows that at most she took insufficient precautions. The fact that she did not take the additional step of requiring goggles does not establish a conscious disregard. And I like that Bilema case, which I also cited, which I, you know, talks about, you know, if you take some action, it's not sufficient to be willful and wanton that you didn't do more. And I think that that's the situation facing us. My time being up, I would just ask that the judgment be reversed. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mead. You will have rebuttal. Mr. Bresny, you may proceed with your argument now, please.
May it please the court, Mr. Mead. Thank you, Your Honors. I do want to correct one thing really quick. Your Honor, Turner, you asked if the beach was closed down. It was closed down for the remaining of the summer, but there was a motion in limine, and I forget, we've litigated this case 13 to 15 years now, if it was the defense or the plaintiff, but that beach reopened. And there was some remedial measures that were done. They cleaned up the bottom. They took out the diving area. So it was reopened for a period of time and then ultimately closed. And there's no evidence that it closed because of this drowning or drownings. So that you could comb the record, but I'm pretty certain on all that. It never came up. It wasn't an issue. And Randy can, you know, agree with me or not on that. But that's my recollection. I will say that, you know, I prepared for the bar argument that counsel made at the end of the close of the case. And in his appellate court, he relied very heavily on Barr. And I noticed that he also is arguing the 2201 discretionary immunity standard. And I have to say that looking at everything in context, with all respect to Mr. Mead, but it boils down to a very simple issue here. And that is that the city has a very thinly veiled attempt to simply eradicate the gross negligence and recklessness from the 3108 exception of willful wanton. That's it. I mean, time and time again, the argument is simply that willful and wanton should only include acts where there is ill intent or motive and intentional harm. And that's their argument. And that, of course, is not the law under willful and wanton. The second argument of that is if you don't buy that for JNOB, then you should allow us to make this broad, overly broad discretionary immunity to bypass the 3108 exception in this case. And so it really kind of boils down to that. The problem with that is that it ignores the Kerwin versus Lincolnshire and all the other cases, including Murray, which Barr heavily relies upon, where the Supreme Court says that there is a wide range of intent that is included in going from just mere degrees past negligence all the way up to intentional. So clearly ill intent or ill motive isn't borne out by the case law or the precedent. The defense advocates that any acknowledgement of safety should be enough to defeat a claim for willful wanton. Any acknowledgement, not just what they listed, but any. And again, that's not the case. Barr doesn't stand for that proposition. And I agree with the defense when they say Barr is not new law. The Supreme Court said that. Barr is not new law. Barr did not say that because the teacher had safety protocols in place, there was no willful wanton. Barr simply said in plain reading of that case that there was no evidence that she knew serious harm was going to occur from the game. Because the only issue it decided was the allegation that she committed willful wanton act by not requiring the safety goggles that were then in their presence. That's it. So it was the knowledge of harm that court turned on. And it relied very heavily on Murray, and it relied very heavily on Hadley. And if you were to take counsel's argument on Barr in this JNOB's argument and apply it to Murray wouldn't exist. There'd be absolute immunity because they provided safety mats around the trampoline. If you applied it to Hadley wouldn't exist because the teacher in Hadley told the kids to stop doing a dangerous thing. And he also told all the kids that they should be wearing safety goggles when they work with metal. So their tortured analysis of the Barr ruling is simply wrong. And it's wrong just by looking at the cases that Barr relied upon. So any safety acknowledgement is not automatically a willful one exception. But that's their argument. So when we look at this, and I really want to talk about Murray, because Murray involves a case of trampolines. The spotters weren't trained. There were national standards that applied that weren't followed. And they even undertook the analysis of 3108 and 2201 and referenced Epstein, their prior decision long ago, that said that 3108 trumps 2201 because of the plain meaning of the statute and its intent. Of course it does, because the intent of the legislature is to make sure that municipalities are not immune from willful and wanton acts. But if you allow 2201 to supersede it, you got an absolute immunity again, which goes against all the cases decided since 1998 when the immunity exception was passed. So what about the knowledge of danger or knowledge of harm in our case was proven? And in JNOV, I mean, credibility of witnesses, counsel at one point made an argument in his brief that the experts canceled out each other. That's not true in a JNOV analysis, as far as I understand. The experts don't cancel each other out. But regardless of the experts, there was testimony time and time again that lifeguard denotes they have to guard lives, that it was important that through the YMCA, the Star Guard, the Red Cross, just to name a few, the U.S. Life-Saving Association, that scanning was surveillance and you needed to do it properly under certain methods, that EAPs needed to be written down and site-specific, that pre-service and in-service training needed to be done. None of these things were done, that EAPs needed to be followed. They also knew that non-swimmers would always go into the mid area. And council said deep end and shallow end. You'll see digging into the evidence, that's not how they referred to it. And they didn't refer to it that way because you have 30 to 40,000 square feet of open water that has all varying different types of heights from 3 feet all the way to 8 feet. And they were inconsistent. And the guards knew this, the patrons didn't. The buoy line was only at 3 feet. So young kids that were under 3 feet would have water up to their chest or their neck. But in the mid area, you could walk 2 swimming pool lengths towards the outer seawall and still have your head above water at 6 feet. That was the evidence. But there were hidden drop-offs that no one knew about. And so they knew these things. They knew that testimony by the guards was that the opaque, turbid nature of the water, Justice Connect, raised the risk of drowning. They knew this. They were trained in this. They knew. And by the way, I don't think any of them were certified in open water except for Ms. Young. I forget her married name now, but she got it the year after this drought. That's my recollection. I of course, rely on the record. Cadney, the guard who was initially responsible, testified the most hazardous, dangerous area, and this was unrebutted, was the diving area. So you got the mid area, the diving area, slide area, and he was trying to do both, diving and mid. Almost every single guard, if not all of them, testified that the scanning requirements for the diving area were different than open water. Diving area required a constant, continuous surveillance so the kids got up safely, got on the board safely, went to the end of the board safely, went in the water, came back up out of the water, and got out of the way before the next kid. If the next kid was there, you had to watch them too. That's important because we proved there was no supervision of the mid area at all by Caveney. Caveney testified he was certified at YMCA and he went by the 10-10 scanning rule. He had to see everybody in his open area every 10 seconds. But then he said for a child to get on the dock and go through that procedure, it would take 30 seconds. Eric drowned saving his brother who was drowning, who fell in a drop off less than 10 feet away from Caveney's chair to the right. Caveney had to turn to the left and he was watching the diving area. That's what he testified to. Now he may have flip-flopped and crossed and recrossed, but that was the testimony. And again, credibility is not an issue here. It's just what the jury likely were to look at and accept. So what we have here is, and that was the digital exhibit that's on a thumb drive that we submitted, where our expert, a lifeguard, Mr. Dworkin, showed there's no way you could do a 10-10 scan or any scan of the open air mid area and wash the diving gear at the same time. That's number one. That's willful and wanton because they knew they had to do it safely. That was the evidence. Number two, no whistle was found. Now, counsel said, yeah, they blew the whistle. He's right. They did. Context is key. Ms. Young was a head lifeguard. She was right behind the slide chair, which was just behind the mid-area chair where Caveney was. She was walking on the sand. She heard Gobble, the slide chair guard, yell, clear the water. She didn't hear a whistle. And then he told her, we got a report of a missing person. But they didn't know where, they didn't know when, she didn't see Caveney. They went out in the 30, 40,000 square feet of water, just started diving around the deep water in the diving area. After a few minutes, she said, I think her testimony was 3 minutes, she realized no other guards were coming. So she blew her whistle. They still didn't come. She blew it 15 times to get the guards down to the beach. Minutes had passed, crucial minutes, unrebutted. 6 to 7 minutes is what time you have to rescue someone who's gone submerged before they die. They know this. This is known. So when everyone gets down there, the head guard says, we need to do a line search. That's the EAP. And no one listened. Eventually, a patron got everyone to do line search. And in under 3 minutes, that's how long it took to do the line and to find Eric. Under 3 minutes. That's Ms. Young. She's a head guard. I mean, that's the testimony that we have here. Not one lifeguard testified that they ever practiced the emergency action plan for missing persons, which is what Eric was. Not one lifeguard. Some said that they did other things, but everyone admitted never practiced the missing person emergency action plan. Again, these are things taught to them to get their certifications. They knew they had to practice in-service training time and time again in EAP, and they chose not to do it. They knew they had to scan a certain way. They chose not to have more guards. They had 10 to 12 guards that day. They only allowed two to do the most hazardous, dangerous area in the facility, as well as this very large swath of water, 2 to 3 swimming pool lengths from the chair all the way to the seawall and over. So we get to this. I mean, you go to Mr. Dworkin, he says they consciously disregarded the safety of the patrons based on not surveilling properly, based on not practicing EAP, based on not blowing the whistle, based on not doing everything immediately. Just Young testified. It had to be done immediately and within seconds. And for the cherry on the top, Ms. White said, hypothetically, no one knew that Eric couldn't swim because Mr. Caveney panicked and went to the furthest, darkest region of the facility, and he didn't tell anybody other than Gobble. She said, if I was told he didn't know how to swim and he was there, I'd have sounded my whistle, we'd have formed a line, we'd have found him in under 3 minutes. And that's the case. And Mr. Dworkin gave his opinions, and he went and talked about what is known in the industry using all these standards. So when I hear counsel say that there's not enough facts, and he brings up my complaint, which was never brought up before, I have to say, if any case showed that there was more than enough knowledge of danger and ordinary care not being used to prepare for that danger or to respond to that danger, it's this case. Multiple witnesses testified to that. So I go to the next step, the 2201 immunity. We believe it was waived. It wasn't brought up initially, like counsel said in his brief. The first appeal was 2015. Discretionary immunity was never argued. It was never argued post-trial motion. There was never a motion for summary judgment on the issue, as far as I can remember, certainly not before this court now. It was waived because there was never an objection to any of the evidence based on that standard. It was waived because they have the burden of proving the affirmative defense, and yet there's never been an itemization of what actions or acts fall under the discretionary immunity. No special interrogatory was given to the jury. But more importantly, it doesn't apply because Murray goes through the language of the statute. And I already talked about that. So, and Epstein was the case it relied on as well, where it refers to 2201 says, except as otherwise provided by statute, right at the beginning. And the Tort Immunity Act is a statute. And again, that makes perfect logical sense. Carving out the willful and wanton exception to 3018 was meant to make municipalities liable for willful wanton acts. If you allow them to do discretionary and supervision type matters, then you run into a slippery hill. Obviously, you just negate the whole exception to the rule. Not only that, scanning, following the EAP, and this was marked and it's an exhibit, it was printed, it was given to the guards, they knew about it, they testified about it, are ministerial acts. Not to mention, almost every guard said that they were mandatory and they had to be followed. That was just the opposite of Sam's discretion. Now Mr. Meade got a couple of them to say, well, they could use their good judgment, they could do this, but they were impeached. At their testimonies and their depositions or the prior trial, they said that these things were mandatory. And again, question of fact goes to the jury in a JNOV, as far as I understand. So when I look at this, I look at this case, we've litigated for many years, and I think, what else could you do to prove willful and wanton? And you look at the cases we cited to, and you go through them, and if you take and accept the defendant's argument, what Barr stands for, and you apply it to all those other cases, they would all be over. They would all be in favor of the defense. It's the illogical argument. I understand why they want to do it. And I understand, you know, we want to make this policy argument, but it's the legislature that makes policy, and they did in this case. They carved out a willful want exception in response to the plea of, I believe, the appellate court in the late 90s on a drowning case. We don't want our lifeguards or our people that take care of us have the opportunity to not be liable at all for just sitting idly by. Because that's what they could do. They could do all that. It's gross negligence, mere degrees past regular negligence, all the way up to intentional. And the jury, as Justice Turner, you pointed out, were adequately informed. We agreed on 14 or 15 itemizations. They went to the jury. They knew what the law was, and they applied the facts. And all facts, there is more than enough facts about the knowledge of dangers and the responses needed to be done to protect safety of others were ignored. All reasonable inferences are in our favor. So when counsel brings up these things like the safety things they did, I think it doesn't address the true nature of willful wanton analysis. It certainly doesn't follow Barr. And you look at these things that he's talking about, and even with those, you have issues of fact. There's a photograph of Mr. Caveney that day in the chair sitting improperly without a tube and without a whistle. There was a photograph taken of the signage, and it doesn't say stay on one side of the buoy line if you're not a swimmer or you can't swim. It says stay in shallow water. For a 6-foot person, shallow would be chest or neck, just like any child in the smaller end. And that's exactly what he did all day. They weren't forced playing before Michael slipped into the drop-off. We have two independent witnesses saying that the guards were just floating sporadically without doing anything for minutes. And they had no bone in this case. They had to run down and try and help. It was so much inaction that they were upset that they felt the need to get involved.
Counsel, how many lifeguards were on duty on the day of the drowning?
The testimony varies, Justice. It's between 10 and 12. And the testimony was there's typically between 14 and 15 for an average sunny day, which this was in June. So, you know, they had 10 to 12, but only two lifeguards were put in the guard stations. There was a guard station located on the diving platform, and you had various testimony about why that was or wasn't used. And defendant's main witness, Guernsey Hopkins, I believe was her name, testified she had always used that station to guard the diving area. And then they called an officer Blankenship. I think her name's Blankenship. She's a police officer now for the city. But she said that she thought it was unsafe, but then I had to impeach her with her testimony from years before, which she said the only reason why she didn't use it, not because she was not licensed lifeguard, but because there was goose feces on it.
Mr. Brezzi, so, I'm kind of like for you to respond to Mr. Meade's argument, which I'll kind of paraphrase, probably not as articulate as he did, but there's 10 or 12 lifeguards there. They're certified, or at least most of them are. There's a buoy line of demarcation between the shallow end and the deep end. They have all kinds of equipment. They've had some training, although not the training that the plaintiff is complaining about here. And there's managers. Well, all of this, how, when the city has done these things, does that equate to a conscious disregard for the safety of others? It seems like we're talking about negligence here instead of willful and wanton conduct. If you have no lifeguards or only three or four lifeguards and you have no buoy line, those things that would tend to suggest willful and wanton, something above negligence. So what's your response to the argument that I've, again, tried to paraphrase that Mr. Mead presented earlier?
Yes, Your Honor, and I appreciate that question. I'll tell you that this case follows almost identically to the cases we cited, including the Supreme Court case in Murray. You've got standards of care. The duty, which isn't disputed here, is borne out by, you know, voluntary undertaking. But when you have standards that require you to do things to make drownings, you know, to protect people, then those weren't followed. And that means the standard of care was chosen to be ignored. In this case, not supervising the mid area, and also not activating your EAP or practicing it. You know, the things that you talk about, Your Honor, you know, buoy line, it didn't divide the deep and the shallow end. I already talked about that. Everything key is in context. Signage didn't say stay on this side. In fact, it was number 5 down under food. Don't eat food in the water. It wasn't even testified that he would have even seen these signs or been able to discern what they meant. Having managers, having certified lifeguards and being relying on them, I mean, that's just kind of, in my mind, raising the bar as well, saying, well, they've got a piece of paper, they're certified, that's all we have to do. What they did is they adopted the certifications and the policies and procedures that required those certifications, and they ignored those things, and that's what was proven, Your Honor. And that's what I believe the evidence borne out sufficiently.
You're out of time, but I have one more question. How did plaintiffs prove Eric would have survived but for defendant's conduct?
Yeah. And this, of course, was a one-line argument made in the brief by counsel, which wasn't raised on appeal or in the post-trial motion. It's a causation argument, but I did mention it earlier, Judge. There is vast amounts of testimony from all the guards that somebody who submerges underwater will perish approximately 6 to 7 minutes, okay? So being submerged that long, that's how long it will take. And they vary a little bit, between 6 and 7 minutes. They found Eric well under 3 minutes once the line was formed. And Ms. Hunter is the one that testified that, but for them not doing the EAP right away, they would have found him well under 3 minutes. And that's what went in. And of course, that was backed up by Mr. Dworkin and some others. The line search, he was found 8 to 10 feet from the guard chair. Once they started the line, which only took seconds to form once they got somebody with authority, they walked a couple steps and they found him. And he was exactly where Michael told Caveney he was. And that's Caveney's testimony. He was exactly where Michael told him he went under. And that's the issue. I mean, I just, you know, I mean, that's the but for. And again, I stand on my waiver argument, but also I think there's enough facts there that were presented to for the jury to rely upon.
Okay, you are out of time unless Justice Connect or Justice Laird has questions.
No, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay. Any rebuttal?
Yeah, I don't want to get in too far into the evidentiary weeds, but some bold misstatements of the facts have to be countered. Dennis Caveney was not panicked. I mean, he's a Homeland Security officer now, and I think it's kind of insulting to depict him in that way. He was the hero of this operation. He was told, my brother is right here. And he did a grid search himself immediately because he recognized that time was of the essence. When that didn't produce him in that very area that he was later found in, he said, are you sure he's here? And he was told, and all the lifeguards, almost all of them, testified and verified this, that the compatriots of Eric Jones and the people on the beach that were also in their party were saying, no, he's out by the seawall. Now, there's quite a different standard, and the evidence will show this, between the EAPs. If an EAP is person missing, you form a line search and you even have people go look in the locker room. This is person missing, known to be underwater, location known. And that distinction was brought out. And that is, you get to him as fast as you can, because time's of the evidence. He's being suffocated. And it's more like 3 minutes that he has to live, not five or six, if I recall the testimony correctly. But we're not here to argue causation. I don't want to try this case a third time. And I'm sure Todd doesn't on a factual basis. But the point is that they did not sit idly by. They did not sit in the chair. Oh, your brother's missing. Oh, too bad. Hey, run and get me a soda, will you? It's nothing like that. That would be the type of misconduct which would be willful and wanton under the legislature's definition of that term as a utterly failing in your purpose, consciously disregarding it. That's not us at all. This was immediate reaction. I want to talk about the since Todd brought it up, Mr. Bresny brought it up, the idea that somebody should have been on the diving platform. I think pretty much uniformly the guards testified that was not a good idea, because the diving board itself, the way that chair was located, and these properties have been in this condition going back to at least the 1940s from what I've seen in Facebook photos. The diving board itself obscured the lifeguard's vision of the area beyond the board. So it was more dangerous to guard that area, and it was actually safer to guard the area from the deep end chair where Mr. Caveney was located. Now, look at me. The evidence was this. If you're guarding that lifeguard, the diving platform and the mid area, you're going to have to move your head that much. That's all you have to do to effectively, that was what the evidence was, to effectively scan that. And that's exactly what Caveney was doing, and responded appropriately to the situation presented him. And then the lifeguards were all misdirected by Eric Jones's companions. Oh, he's out by the wall. I saw bubbles. He's out there. And so they have to play with the cards they are dealt. There's several other things. We did not waive discretionary. We briefed that and argued that. Justice White's Rule 23 order from the first appeal focused instead on the inappropriate use of evidence by the plaintiff and reversed on that basis. So it's not waived at all. And there's basically everything we are accused of doing wrong involves discretion. And should be totally immune from that basis. But more importantly, I think if you look back at the case law and the one involving the Gatorade spilled on the floor that I quoted in my brief, where the principal had her husband stand by the puddle and guard it, and a student runs up anyway, slips, he tries to catch her. They said, no, you've tried to do something, just like in this case here. The fact that you didn't do more cannot seat liability in a case like that. Is my time up? I think it is.
It's not up yet if you have anything else.
Well, I think if you read Barr, whether or not it's smack on appropriate with this case, I think that evidences the policy considerations that are involved in this case. And in the other cases, same type of a thing. We want to protect municipalities from negligence liability. Therefore, we enact this standard. And the effect, though, of the way this case and many others plays out is it ends up reading more like negligence. And it's up to the courts to keep those cases from going to verdict.
Mr. Reed, your time is now up.
Thank you
for your argument. Also, thank you, Mr. Bresny, for your argument. The case is submitted, and the court will stand in recess until 1 o'clock this afternoon.